Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. It is Martin Luther King Jr. Day. I'm Charlie Sykes.
Just as I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today.
I still think of that as one of the great moments in American oratory. So we need to gear up for what is coming our way, the impeachment trial of Donald J. Trump. And as much as you think you know about all of this, it is worth reminding ourselves that this is only the third time in American history that an American president has gone on trial in front of the United States Senate. So we are joined by Adam White, resident scholar at AEI, to break down some of the law and the role of the Senate. So thanks for joining us again, Adam.
Well, it's good to be here, Charlie, anytime. But on this particular day, we're all called to remember what it means to be citizens, what it means to have a constitution. What better day than to discuss these important issues?
Okay, but before we get into impeachment, though, speaking of making decisions and taking a stand, the New York Times editorial board, everybody's got to have a shot on this, had this elaborate, much-hyped process to make an endorsement of a candidate for president. And, you know, drum roll, please, they decided not to make a choice, really. So they do a joint endorsement of Elizabeth Warren and Amy Klobuchar. And the way they explained it, that, you know, there's a choice between the radical approach to the primary and the realist approach. And so instead of choosing, they picked one from each column. So it's such a strange moment that you have this endorsement that is a non-endorsement. And you have any take on it, Adam?
Yogi Berra once said, if you reach a fork in the road, take it. And that seems to be what the New York Times did this time. Obviously, the media industry is changing a lot, and it's an open question how important newspaper editorials are anymore. But you'd think that at least the newspapers themselves would still take them seriously, and the New York Times here just didn't. Frankly, I was a little relieved. I kind of wondered if maybe they just go totally meta, kind of like Time magazine a few years ago, where they said that the man of the year was you, and it had not you personally, Charlie, but they had a mirror, and you half expected the New York Times to endorse the voters. Yeah,
you know, you're right. You're right about that. And by the way, I need to warn people that I'm heavily on cold medication, so if I start to say things that sound completely crazy, I blame it on the drugs. Just so we do this. No, I'm kind of a crank on this issue of newspaper editorials. And so just leaving aside the New York Times for a moment and their inability to make a choice, I just think the institutional, you know, anonymous voice of the newspaper endorsement is so anachronistic, and it's so self-destructive, I think, to the media. So, you know, 99% of the time, right, the media is trying to claim that we are unbiased, we don't have an agenda, we don't choose sides. And then you have this endorsement, which I know, you know, fairly or not, And I understand the distinction between opinion and bias, but it does feed the perception that the newspaper takes a side, because the headline is always, you know, whether it's the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel endorses candidate X or the New York Times endorses candidate Y, it looks like they've made a choice. So it has undermined journalism's claim to be fair and objective. Without actually moving the needle, because this endorsement is not going to have any effect. I suppose the only political take on it is that everybody thought it was going to be Warren because she's the perfect New York Times editorial board candidate. So the fact that they gave a shout out to Amy Klobuchar is the surprise. And frankly, she needed a little bit of a boost at this stage in her campaign.
I think it's very honest of the New York Times that they understood. This seems to be a concession to reality that Senator Warren brings to this candidacy such profound problems, both politically, temperamentally, stylistically, and basic fundamental questions about her honesty. Senator Klobuchar, whatever you think of her policies, doesn't carry nearly that much baggage. She had the other stuff about her personality and sort of the leaks from her former staff that made her look like the star of the TV show Veep. But I think the Times, I agree with you. I expected them to endorse Senator Warren, and the fact that they had to have this major caveat, I think, was a good concession to reality.
No, they did. In fact, it's rather extraordinary how they walk through the impracticality and the problems with Elizabeth Warren. I also thought it was interesting they made the note that they obviously, it gave them pause, the stories about Amy Klobuchar berating her staff members. But then they point out that, you know, we've had similar reports about Bill Clinton and Donald Trump. And yet you don't see that as being, you know, center to the critique of their candidacies or their presidencies. I guess that was a point. OK, so deep breath here. The trial of Donald J. Trump starts tomorrow.
Right.
And you have a piece up on the Bulwark that makes, I think, a fundamental point that President Trump is not the only one on trial. The House is on trial, and so is the Senate. So, you know, they began this process by taking this oath to do impartial justice. I don't know how many members of the Senate really took that seriously, but what do you mean when you say that the Senate is on trial?
The oath, I think, is a good place to start. For weeks, ever since the House voted on impeachment, there's been speculation about whether McConnell or Graham, who clearly have staked out positions in favor of the president, could take that oath honestly. And of course, the same could be said for Senator Warren or any of the other senators on the Democratic side who clearly have staked out positions. And so that's where I began with this essay. How can a partisan senator do impartial justice? And the point I tried to make in this piece is that to understand what that oath means, we need to understand both what the Senate is and is it what the founders intended it to be. And also, we need to look at the words that preceded impartial justice in the oath, namely the trial of the impeachment of Donald J. Trump. We're so used to saying that the president's on trial, and of course he is. More broadly than that, the impeachment itself is on trial. The Senate is trying the House's factual and legal judgments, but also their prudential judgments. And so that's where I tried to begin to walk through what it means for the Senate to do impartial justice. And it all comes back to, as I said, an eye to what the Senate was intended to do generally, which was to be a check and balance against both the House of Representatives and the presidency.
Talk about that for a little bit, the specific role, how the Senate was conceived by the Founding Fathers.
We're used to thinking of Congress as checking and balancing the president. And we know a little bit about what it means for the Senate to check and balance the House. Famously, George Washington saying that the Senate would be the saucer that cools the hot coffee that comes out of the House. I think we've forgotten, though, the really special relationship between the Senate and the presidency. I, in this essay, as so often, I quote a lot from The Federalist, but I walk through the ways in which the founding fathers, especially Hamilton and Madison, expected and intended for the Senate to be deeply invested in the work of administration, not micromanaging it. The president's in charge. He has the duty to take care of the laws are faithfully executed, and he has the executive power. But the framers understood that the president would, even good presidents would have every temptation and incentive to misuse that power. And so they gave the Senate some particularly important checkpoints. One is on the appointment of officers. And Hamilton has a beautiful paper on this in The Federalist where he says presidents will, of course, want to appoint their own people. They'd rather just appoint the people they trust and know, or their lackeys and their cronies or their relatives. Of course, such a thing would never happen in this day and age, right? And that's precisely why the Senate needed to be there as at least a silent sort of guard, and when it needs to be, a not silent guard, preventing the president from indulging those impulses. And one of the real problems throughout this administration, the previous administration, and I think though it's really, you see its fruits now, is the Senate, when it's of the same party as the president, shows so little interest in actually wielding those tools. There's no interest in the Senate right now on the Republican side to really force the president to not rely on a bunch of acting agency heads. Or at the crux of the Ukraine matter, this whole shadow diplomacy. Republicans in the Senate say the president's entitled to his foreign policy. That's true to an extent, not completely true, but it's certainly not true that the president can just staff up an entire sort of diplomatic mission around the operation of the Senate, especially with its advice and consent power. Now, and so I focused on that and other things.
No, I mean, you make this point. I'm going to read from your article here. The founding generation entrusted these judgments to the Senate because they intended the Senate to embody a mix of both accountability and statesmanship, and to be deeply invested in the administration of government power. So the executive branch always takes the lead in administration. The framers, you write, intended for the Senate to temper the executive's worst instincts in crucial ways. And then you go through the, you know, making of treaties, the, you know, appointment of officials. This was what Hamilton really expected to animate senators in an impeachment. And so leaving the impeachment aside for the moment, why do you think the Senate, which has this august and specific role, has been so willing to abrogate its power? Why I've asked this question over and over again, and I still don't understand why the Senate has allowed themselves to be so diminished, even leaving aside the partisan impulses.
I think a large part of the answer is it's the same for the House being so diminished, right? The changes in political parties, in communications, in the way our politics works has really eroded the institutional ties that the founders expected each part of government to have to the institution itself. That's all gone, of course, and that's true of the House. I think in the Senate, and this really comes through in the last few years, you look at what does Senator McConnell and the Republican senators want to focus on? They want to focus on confirming judges. Mm-hmm. And I sure love that. They've confirmed a ton of really great judges, so, including some people I know personally, mm-hmm. and admire immensely. And I'm so glad. But McConnell, he gave a very telling interview a year or two ago where he said, if given the choice between confirming a judge who's going to be on the court forever and confirming some deputy secretary of this or that who's going to be in office for just a couple of years, he says it's not a hard choice to make. And in one sense, I understand that calculus. In the other sense, that's no way to run the government, especially the constitutional government that expected and really needed the Senate to, as I said, invest its time and resources in the administration side of things. But Republicans, I think, and Democrats alike have seen that there's really not much political bang for the buck there, that the voters, the president, the parties, everybody want them to focus on these other things to the real detriment of the institution and therefore to the detriment of constitutional government in general.
Well, let's talk about what's in the news today, what's being debated. Alan Dershowitz, who is either on the president's team or not on the president's team or whatever, has been giving serial interviews where he is contending that abuse of power is not grounds for impeachment. He's also insisting that you need to violate a specific criminal statute, which apparently is completely opposite of what he said in the past. But let's focus on abuse of power. Again, Alan Dershowitz says that even if President Trump abused his power, that is not a grounds for impeachment.
I just disagree. Let me say off the bat, by the way, Alan Dershowitz was one of my very first law school professors and one of my favorite law school professors. I actually admire him immensely, although sometimes he's a little cartoonish. I just disagree with this argument, though. It's true that the impeachment standards are pretty high. It's true that they are phrased in terms of treason, bribery, or high crimes and misdemeanors, which on its face seems to require crime. But if you look at the history of how this has been interpreted over the years, you look at how the founders debated it, it's not limited to crimes per se. Misdemeanors does not mean necessarily misdemeanors in the current legalistic sense. And Hamilton, when he described impeachment, the Federalist, he said, these are things that are a violation of the public trust. Now, I understand what Dershowitz's argument is. He's saying the framers spoke broadly of impeachment as a violation of the public trust, a political malfeasance. He says that's the reason why we have impeachment, but impeachment, its operational terms are purely legal and focused on crimes. I think he's just literally misinterpreting the text. Now, you saw the legal brief that President Trump and his lawyers filed, and they lead with this point. This is clearly the crux of their argument. but they are at odds with the entire history of impeachment of judges and presidents, and they're at odds with what the framers said. In fact, I even quote in my article, I don't have the specific language in front of me, but at one point, Hamilton, in a later essay, everybody focuses on Federalist 65 and 66, because that's mostly that's focused squarely on impeachment. But later in Federalist, I think 77, where he wraps up his discussion of executive power, focusing one last time on impeachment, he says the abuse of executive authority. He says it right there. And no, one last caveat. At the Philadelphia Convention in 1787, where they first framed up the Constitution, there was a debate over whether impeachment could reach what they called maladministration. And Madison said, oh, we can't do this. It would turn our government into a prime ministership where the president would really be at the whims of Congress. So I agree that impeachment was not the right tool for just run-of-the-mill maladministration, the Senate not liking the president's policies. But that's not to say that truly extraordinary and fundamental misuse of executive power in ways that directly undermine constitutional governance is not impeachable. I think it is, and I think that's what's at issue in the Ukraine situation.
So correct me if I'm getting this quote wrong, because I don't have it in front of me. So somebody asked Dershowitz over the weekend, so if Russia invaded Alaska and the president did nothing to defend the country and just allowed Russia to take over Alaska, would that be an impeachable offense? And he said no. So would that be a misuse of power, maladministration? Where would that fall in this continuum that we're discussing?
Yeah, of course it would be impeachable. I was traveling a bit yesterday, so I didn't get to see the exact exchange. I saw an account of it. And I think Dershowitz, by taking his argument to its logical conclusion, shows how totally wrong how his argument itself is. I should say, by the way, having used that phrase, taking things to the logical conclusion, that's one of the key parts of the Senate's role here. You see both the House and the president making broad categorical judgments. The House has just impeached the president for his assertion of executive privilege, something that part of the impeachment I'm very wary of. But then the president, in his team's legal brief, makes the opposite categorical argument. They say that the president could never be impeached for invoking executive privilege. The job of the Senate is to draw prudential distinctions between those two absolutist arguments. I think it would be a mistake for the Senate to impeach the president for assertions of executive privilege. Executive privilege is very important for the workings of constitutional government, and it always has been. But we can't be just mindlessly absolutist about this. If executive privilege is being misused in specific instances in ways that exacerbate these constitutional offenses, then the Senate should abrogate executive privilege in some limited ways. But the key here is it's not all or nothing. The Senate has to make judgments.
Okay, this is such an important point, and it is this nuanced point that I want to sort of underline here, because you do describe here these colliding institutional interests. You know that the president does have executive privilege, but then the House oversight, the responsibility of the House to provide oversight, is fundamental to the House's exercise of its constitutional powers. So there's some tension here. So as you point out, so the job for the Senate now, you know, as it was for the Supreme Court in the Nixon tapes case, is to sort of balance these things, right? To reject the categorical assertions of power and to make, as you just said, these prudential judgments that strike the best possible balance between the House's and the president's powers. Okay, so, Adam, what is that best possible balance?
Let me just say at the outset really quick, this is an issue I explored a few months ago in The Bulwark in a piece called Collision of Constitutional Powers. There's just a fascinating mirror image between the two arguments. There's no express constitutional power of congressional oversight. There's no oversight power listed in the Constitution. But the oversight power is clearly implicit. It's necessary to make the other parts of Congress's powers work. And on the other side of this, there's no executive privilege in the Constitution. But it's necessary, and the framers anticipated it as necessary, for the workings of the president's express constitutional powers. So the question is then, how do you balance these two? And for me, I think the key is for the Senate to look at the facts that have been alleged with respect to Ukraine, this entire thing, see what information is already available in the public domain. What do they need? They're not like a trial court. They're not limited to what happens to be said in the proceeding. The whole point is they can look at, and we hope that they will look out at the world at what's already known. To the extent that there are questions left about the president's intentions or motivations, the extent to which the Senate thinks that those issues, those substantive issues, rise to the level of impeachable offense, to the extent they think that testimony from Bolton, Mulvaney, or others is necessary for them to come to an informed judgment on the constitutional issue, then I do think they need to stand firm against the assertion of executive privilege, litigate it if necessary. Will they ever litigate it under Senator McConnell? I seriously doubt it. But that, I think, is what they ought to do.
So basically, this seems to be what's playing out right now, although things are still fluid, that they're going to hear the arguments from the House managers and from Trump's team, and then they will vote on whether or not they're going to solicit testimony and more evidence, correct? And again, we're looking for four Republican senators who would conceivably join with all the Democrats in supporting that motion, gets to 51 votes, and then they are subpoenaed.
Yes, and I think that's exactly the right way to go about this. I think we shouldn't have these arguments about witnesses, these all or nothing arguments about witnesses in the abstract. I think the Senate needs to sit down and decide what if the senators think they know now, and then what would witnesses help to inform. And I know I said this earlier, but I want to repeat it. This is where the whole metaphor of a jury is so wrong
for this situation.
We expect jurors in a criminal sense to be ignorant. If you've ever been called for jury duty, you know if you walk up and you know the facts of the case or you know anybody involved, you're going to get thrown out. This is the opposite. This is why the Senate is a jury, so to speak, for this type of proceeding. We want these jurors not to be ignorant. We want them to already, because they're deeply invested in the work of administration and in public affairs, to know the basic facts, to not limit their judgment to what happens to be said in the trial. And of course, they're not going to limit themselves to what's said in the trial. All these senators, Democratic and Republican, are coming with these outside bases of knowledge.
Okay, I'm going to put a pin on this particular point here. So you're right. I mean, a normal jury would be sequestered and would not be able to get this outside information. Some of the Republicans are arguing that the trial should be limited to the record created by the House and only that record. You are saying that there's nothing that prevents the senators from, for example, downloading recent stories from Just Security or the New York Times reporting on, you know, when, you know, various emails that were written in various timelines, that this is it does not violate their oath in any way whatsoever, that they are not bound by that specific narrow record.
Yes, exactly. And this is one of the most maddening things about this process as an outside observer, is both sides are trying to have it both ways. On the one hand, we saw Democrats sort of heckling Republicans like McConnell and Graham, saying they need to be impartial jurors. They can have no preconceived notions. But of course, the Democrats themselves throughout this trial, the Democratic senators, they are already talking about Lev Parnas and all these other things that are not technically in the record. Republicans, on the other hand, want to have it the other way. They want to sort of make clear, not all Republicans, but a lot of them, want to make clear that they have preconceived ideas and judgments made. But then when it comes to this witness question or documents, they say, oh, we can't consider anything that wasn't already raised in the House. So they want to be both bound by the proceeding but not bound by the proceeding. And the fact is, again, there's a reason why this was given to the Senate rather than, say, the Supreme Court, which is one option that was considered and rejected by the founders, is give it to this body that's already deeply engaged in governance and have them make these decisions, because these are not legalistic or merely factual decisions. And I think it would be egregious for the senators to go into this with blinders like racehorses, not looking outside of their lane and making immensely consequential judgments of the greatest magnitude in the eyes of history, pretending to not know facts that we all know.
Yeah, that may seem the easy way for them, but it's a very, very dangerous choice for them to make, especially because they don't know how much more evidence is going to come out. So
yes,
the vote to not have witnesses or evidence becomes toxic if more evidence appears. And then, of course, they have to ask, what's going to emerge between now and the election, because this is a fundamentally political process. Now, I happen to believe, and I'm just to bounce this off you, and I've said this publicly, that I did think that the House Democrats made a mistake by rushing the process, by not pressing for more documents, for not having more witnesses and subpoena, that the more time to build that case would, the better. And that as a result, they're going in there I think it's enough evidence, but still, if you're going to remove the president of the United States, you ought to, make sure you cross every T and dot every I. But that does not change the Senate's fundamental obligation to do the full investigation that you're describing. So it is possible to think the Democrats should have done a better job, but that does not let the Senate off the hook.
I agree.
Okay.
I agree completely, both with respect to the House's shortcomings. Again, wanting to have it both ways. Sometimes they talked about their process as though it were a grand jury that just comes up with allegations. But now at the end, they want their decision to be treated as a real judgment in the eyes of history. Right. That was, as Nancy Pelosi said, he's been impeached. That can never be undone. But now Democrats sort of more broadly are back to saying, oh, the House proceeding was just the beginning of things, not the end. Now, among the prudential judgments that the Senate has to make is how far to go in its own investigation. You don't want the House to be able to sort of do things on the quick and easy, and then the Senate have be doing sort of the real work. You don't want the Senate impeachment trial to become a fishing expedition. So I would say the senators need to be careful about this. But I agree with you that they shouldn't just forswear their own investigation. They might want to put on blinders for legalistic reasons, but the voters won't put on blinders, and the eyes of history certainly won't put on blinders.
So you specifically say that the Senate should scrutinize the president's use of shadow diplomacy, which is at the heart of the Ukraine affair. What does that involve?
We keep hearing that the president's entitled to his own foreign policy. Mm-hmm. That's not even entirely true. So much of, as a matter of law, foreign policy is fixed by legislation, by treaties, and so on. The president's not perfectly free. But, of course, he does have a lot of latitude for good reasons, good constitutional reasons. But what he's not allowed to do is just staff up his administration with officers, with ambassadors, and others outside of the Senate's constitutional authority to give its advice and consent or deny its advice and consent to the appointment of these officers. This is not a bright, clear line. It's very fuzzy, and presidents have always had back channels and informal advisors and so on. This is one of those places where the Senate has to make a judgment over whether what the president has done evades that power. I'm not saying the Senate should impeach him or should remove him from office for relying on Rudy Giuliani, but what now we're looking at are the fruits of that. Rather than going through the normal order of business, instead relying on Giuliani and these other cronies, and seeing sort of the chaos that ensued, the lack of accountability, and the really dubious results, the Senate needs to understand that part of the problem here is just the breakdown of the Senate's own role in being a check and balance against the president in constructing foreign policy.
So that gets to the question of the precedent, because whatever the Senate does, it will have an historic precedent, and there will be consequences, both short term in terms of how Donald Trump will treat exoneration and how he might behave, but also longer term. And what I'm really, really struck by? Republicans who have gone along with the president's extensive expansion of executive power, and this includes the executive orders, they must in the back of their minds know the precedent that they are setting. And I'm listening and watching to people like Elizabeth Warren, who seems to be taking notes about things that the president can do unilaterally. Yeah. And this is something that I'm a little surprised that more conservatives are not waving the red flag, saying, look, if you're willing to grant the executive this kind of authority because he's doing things you like, what are you going to say when it is a President Elizabeth Warren or a President Bernie Sanders who are now out there, you know, pledging to wipe out all student debt by executive fiat, moving trillions of dollars around without congressional action whatsoever?
We saw this a year ago with the debate over the border wall funding and emergency powers. It's the exact same thing. People look at these events, partisans, and instead of, you know, of course they denounce them and they always say it's an abuse of executive power. But mostly what they do is take notes on how they could apply that in the future. You know, I've had a lot of interesting discussions about this. When I'm not at AEI, I'm at George Mason running a program called the Center for the Study of the Administrative State. And oftentimes people will say to me, you know, isn't it great that President Trump has been the first president to really rein in the administrative state? And I say he's done a lot of good things on reg reform and so on. But when you look at the policies he really cares the most about, immigration, trade, he's bulked up the administrative state. He's used it. He's used executive power and administrative power to great applause among conservatives who are ostensibly opposed to the administrative state on things like environmental regulation. And that's the exact same dynamic we're seeing here. Republicans cheering him on, Democrats denouncing it while making clear that what they're really looking for is a roadmap to use this approach for their own policies.
So what do you think is going to happen over the next few days? How long will this trial go, do you think? What's your best guess?
I don't have the foggiest idea, yeah. But I will say this.
Good answer.
One of the joys of this line of work is I'm sometimes contacted by congressional staff or legislators asking for advice on things. For all of the crass politics at its worst that we've seen, I have been privy to really interesting discussions with congressional staff, senator staff, including some of the ones that aren't so obvious. You know, everybody's focused on a few senators, and I've gotten a couple of interesting inquiries where even the senators who you wouldn't think of as you know, squishy moderates or something, they're thinking through these things pretty deeply. I don't expect a whole lot of Republicans to vote against the president, even on procedural things, let alone on the big vote at the end. I just don't. President Trump is going to be acquitted, whether it takes 2 weeks or 2 months. And I'm sure it's in ways that are going to let us all down, for those of us who think that this process deserves better than it's getting. But the silver lining on this is I have seen some good, thoughtful sort of examination of some of these things about questions of intent and how do you think about the president's intent and how do you strike this balance between privilege and Congress's own prerogatives. And so it's been gratifying in a way. And oftentimes these essays that I write, you know, they're written for to help sort of reiterate and elaborate points I've made in passing and that I hope gets a foothold among people who have to think seriously about these things because it's what they're going to be voting on.
And your piece in The Bulwark ends with a quote from Hamilton. You know, you note that the senators swore an oath to impartial justice. You ask, will they live up to their oath? Hamilton hopes so. When senators try impeachment, he wrote, we must, quote, count upon their pride, if not upon their virtue.
That's right.
Which is exactly right.
And it calls to mind the framers were counting on both a certain measure of Republican virtue among statesmen, but they also were counting on ambition to counteract ambition. But on the side of virtue, or I guess even on both pride and virtue, it calls to mind Bill Kristol and Jeffrey Toulis's really terrific piece today in The Bulwark on the oath. And, you know, I tweeted right before we sat down to tape this, their articles, you know, calls to mind those closing lines of the Declaration of Independence where the signatories of the Declaration, they said, we mutually pledge our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. And you wonder whether today's statesmen could pledge their sacred honor with a straight face. It's hopefully those sorts of lines are inspiring and challenging to today's office holders. Let's hope so. Let's hope it's not just a lot of snickering and blushing.
Adam White is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and the director of George Mason University C. Boyden Gray Center for the Study of the Administrative State. Adam, thank you for spending so much time with us today on the Bulwark Podcast.
Thank you, Charlie.
And thank you for listening to today's podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.